This presentation is brought to you by iAwaken.org, a not-for-profit organization. We hope you enjoy the presentation. Please observe the copyright terms to which you have agreed.
And what we're going to deal with is the concept of stature in Yiddishkeit and Torah. What it means to have stature and what stature is. The dispute, the clash between Esav and Yaakov reaches its peak in this week's Sedra. Everything that's come before is merely a lead-up to the events of this week's Sedra. And the resolution of the clash is also affected in this week's Sedra. The high point of the clash, of course, is the scene where Yaakov battles with the angel, who we're told in the Gemara is Saroi Shel Esav, is the angel of Esav. What does that mean, the angel of Esav? It means the neshama of Esav. It means the Esav inside each one of us. It means the spiritual power which backs Esav. Now, Esav is a concept that we'll discuss in a moment, but basically, Esav exists in every human being, and Esav exists as a nation. And in the same way as the human being needs his animal functions in order to function, but those animal functions could quite easily lead him astray, so the world needs an Esav, needs a nation who is Esav. Although that Esav can cause lots of trouble, we need an Esav. And this neshama, this spiritual concept of Esav, everything has a spiritual concept, we've learned that many times. Even a blade of grass has a neshama, has some kind of spiritual force behind it. So an Esav has a spiritual force behind it. And this spiritual force took on the form of a human being, a real human being. This was no imaginary scene. There's a little bit of discussion among the Rishonim, but it's pointed out after all that Yaakov went away limping. So this was no imaginary fight or nevuah, pure prophecy. It was prophecy in the sense that Yaakov was relating to a spiritual entity, but that spiritual entity took the form of a physical human being, the same as the three visitors that came to meet Avram to tell him about Sarah. And the difficulties, many difficulties in this parasha, but the two difficulties we're going to talk about are the following. The first one is, who won the battle? Has anybody got any views on that? Who won, Yaakov or Esav? Not clear in the Chumash. Yaakov goes away limping, but the Malach gives him a broch in the end. And you were able. So from the words of the Malach, you see that he won. But from the facts, it doesn't look so much. It looks like a kindly Malach is conceding defeat. The only thing who could do?
The Malach.
Could only make him limp. If you've ever had that kind of pain.
No, that's what he says.
Quite some defeat, I must tell you. The Gid HaNoshe, the pain that Yaakov suffered is a very interesting pain, because I've suffered it. It's the tendon that joins the leg, Barry, I don't know what it's called, the tendon that joins the leg to the rest of the body. Pardon? The top of the leg to the rest of the body and enables it to move and controls the movement. Remember, Mark, that time when you caused a bit of trouble. And it wasn't directly, and I must tell you, I was sitting in a hotel room in Korea. I was sitting on it in a chair, and as I got up to go to the telephone, this thing hit me, and whatever it is, I don't know, one tears that kind of ligament, and I was frozen in the position of about 6 centimeters above my chair, absolutely frozen. I couldn't sit down and I couldn't move up, and just then the doorbell went and room service was there. And I said, come in, because I couldn't go and fetch him. And there I was standing. It was rather funny. They'd seen funny things from me before, which they just couldn't understand. So they accepted this. One of those other things. And they were quite impressed with the ritual, in fact. But believe you me, it was painful. And I can imagine further Yaakov's pain, because I imagine that if there were any doctors around that area where Yaakov is, which I very much doubt, they were probably of the same kind of caliber as Korean doctors, and I wasn't going to let myself in the hands of a Korean doctor. So it's not easy. And if that's what happened to him, that's a defeat. You're hurt, you're sore. And the Malach goes away unhurt. The Malach is not hurt in any way. So from the physical point of view, it seems to be that Yaakov loses. From the top, backwards and forwards afterwards, he seems to have won. But it's difficult to see what exactly happened. And then a very fair question, Vayishal Yaakov, Vayomer Agizana, Shim Shmecha.
And Yaakov says, okay, now that we've made friends, can I know who I've had the pleasure to have been fighting with?
Vayomer, he says to him, Lama Zet Yishal Yishmi, what's it got to do with my name?
What do you want to know with what my name is? Vayavarachot Hashem, he blessed him, and that was the end of the story. He never saw him again.
Now, in order to understand this, I must briefly go back to a shiur I gave 3 or 4 years ago, I don't remember, on Parshas Toldos, where we discussed the whole concept of Esav and Yaakov and the relationship with one another. And we said that Yaakov was the Ish Seir, he was the hairy man, the man with the external covering.
Esav,
the man with the external covering. He was an Ishyodei Atzayid, Chazal tell us, he knew how to hunt with his mouth, he knew the art of diplomacy and politics. He could say one thing and mean another thing, and you couldn't be quite sure what he was saying and what he was meaning. And he was the manipulative person, he was the businessman, he was the hunter, he was the physical man. Yaakov was the Ishtam Yoshev Ohalim. Yaakov was the simple man who used to sit and learn. And Yaakov begins to be concerned about the intended relationship. They're born as twins, Yaakov and Esau. That means that in the Ribbono Shel'Olam's mind is that they are two parts of the same being in a sense. That's really what they are. And they're meant to function together as one. Esau will look after the business, Yaakov will look after the Torah, and things can get done. Yaakov gets more and more disturbed about the prospect, particularly when he sees one midah, when he sees one bad characteristic in Esav, coarseness. That's it. When Esav comes back from a day of business and says, give me some of that red stuff, then Yaakov decides that's not my partner. I don't care anything else. He's murdered, I know that he's murdered. He's raped, I know that he's raped. He's done all sorts of terrible things. Can still tolerate him as a partner. The turning point in the relationship between Yaakov and Esav is when Yaakov sees coarseness in Esav. A lack of derech eretz, a lack of refinement, a lack of menschlichkeit. That's not a partner for me, says Yaakov. I don't care how good he is at business. I'm going to have to outsmart him at business. And Esau, Yaakov comes along and he says to Esau, as a further test of his coarseness, you want some of the red stuff? Will you give me your becherah for the red stuff? And Esau says, yes. That's the proof that he's coarse. Right? That spiritual things don't mean anything to him. So he's a good businessman. So what? Is he going to work in his business for Torah? How can a person who is coarse, how can a person who doesn't have refinement work for Torah? We've already said derech eretz kodmo l'Torah. You've got to have a certain basic derech eretz before you start with Torah. And if that isn't there, if he talks about food as stuff, and if he uses coarse language, and if he doesn't care about his bechorah, if he doesn't use about spirit, if he doesn't care about spiritual things, then there's no way this man can be a partner, even in business. And Yaakov starts developing the ability of usurping Esav's role. And the climax of it there is the famous scene when Yaakov stands in front of Yitzchak to get the brocha. And he doesn't want Yaakov's brocha, and he doesn't want Esav's brocha. He wants the lot, because he wants Esav out. And Yaakov says, and Yitzchak says to him after moments of confusion as to who in fact was really standing in front of him, says Yitzchak, Hakol kol Yaakov. And you remember how we explained that. Yitzchak says, my goodness, this is a new being. This is neither of my children. This isn't Yaakov and this isn't Esav. This is a new being. This is a child who has the hands of Esav. He has the technical skills of manipulation that Esav has. But he has that pure inside neshama. He has that voice. He has the ability to speak with the voice of a Yaakov. This is a Yaakov and an Esav combined in one. This is something that I never expected to have altogether. And so Yitzchak gives Yaakov both blessings. Yaakov's blessings and Esav's blessings. And Yaakov is charged with the future of the entire Jewish people. And Esav is disinherited. Now one can understand Esav's bitterness. Okay, he didn't expect to be appointed the chief rabbi of the Jewish people or the Kohen Gadol of the Jewish people.
that he did expect to be the businessman at least. He at least expected to be in charge of running the state and running the business and supporting the Jewish people. And now he's been pushed out altogether. Hence the bitterness against Esau, against Yaakov. And that's why when he comes to Yaakov, to Yitzchak, and he says, haven't you even got a bracha for me? And all Yitzchak has got left to say is, you should be a servant to your brother. That's all I can say. I've given him everything. Because he is everything. He's now got you and him together. He's got both qualities together. Imagine then the reaction in Esau. After all this bitterness has developed, and you can imagine there was this bitterness at the time. Now it's true that time heals a lot of wounds. But time only heals wounds really if it's periods of interaction. If you're disassociated from the thing about which you're feeling sore, it boils inside you more and more and more. It's just you feel sore about somebody, but you see him once, and you see him twice, and you see him a third time, and it's not so bad. And what you're feeling sore about starts becoming less and less. But if you isolate yourself from a person with whom you have a cerebral, you boil and boil and boil, and it gets worse and worse, and he develops horns, and he develops a tail, and you get this terrible apparition of who he really is. You can imagine what happened. So during the years that Yaakov is with Laban, you can imagine what's going on inside Esau. Nevertheless, they don't come into contact with each other. Until now, they're about to come into contact with each other. And they come into contact with each other spiritually before they come into contact with each other physically. But what must be eating Esau up more than anything? He's successful at business too. That's what's eating Esau up. If he wants to be a tzaddik who sits in yeshiva and learns, okay, very nice. And particularly if you call on me to support him, even better. That's fine. But that he should be in my field, and he should be a Talmid Chochem and a Godel B'Torah, and he should be a millionaire as well, and I'm not even such a millionaire. Well, we don't know exactly how wealthy Esau was. It makes no difference. Let's assume that Esau was also very wealthy. But that Yaakov should be a successful businessman and should be a millionaire as well, that he can't tolerate more than anything. And at what moment does the Esau get hold of him? Yaakov is taking his family across this little ford, this river, and he's taking them one at a time, and he puts them on the other side of the river, and he's finally got everything over, and he goes back to search in case there are a couple of little things that he might have forgotten. Says the Gemara in Chulin, that Tzadi Aleph, that we learn from here that Chavivin, the Gemara says that Tzadi Aleph Amud Aleph, Mikan, from here we learn that Tzadikim Shechoviv Aleihim Mamoinam Yoyser Miguf, that Tzadikim love their money more than their bodies. Incredible thing. Tzadikim we're talking about. Love their money more than their bodies. Remember, we had that shir a few weeks ago about the difference between needing a thing and wanting a thing, or having a thing, or liking a thing. We'll never say that a tzaddik needs his money more than his body, but a tzaddik loves his money more than his body. Why? Because, says the Gemara, she'ein poishtin yedeihim begezer, because they don't steal. If you don't steal, money is jolly hard come by. And stealing means stealing as defined by halacha. Not stealing as defined by the government of South Africa. And the dinim of, in halacha, as far as stealing are concerned, are much more severe than the dinim of the government of South Africa. But they certainly include everything which, according to the laws of the government of South Africa, are stealing. Whether it's income tax, whether it's not dealing straight with a partner, whether it's unreasonable profit, whatever it is, taking something which our pi halacha is not yours, that's gezer. And if you don't steal, in their days as in our days, it's jolly hard to make some money. And when you've made a bit of money with your own sweat and toil, that's something you don't waste. That's something you've worked hard for, and that tzaddik's time is so precious. He doesn't measure his time in terms of money. He doesn't measure how much money his time is worth. Sorry, he doesn't measure how much money his time is worth. He measures how much time his money is worth. That's all. It took me. He looks at an article that he bought, and he works out how many hours work it is, not how many rands. He's not interested in how many rands. How many hours work was this? How many hours couldn't I learn because I had to work for this little pot or pan or a little floor brush or a vacuum cleaner or a motor car? That's how he measures the value of a thing. And when he's spent 50 hours or 2 hours or half an hour working to be able to get this little thing, he doesn't leave it lying over there because he's too lazy to go back and check whether it's still there. He looks after his objects. He looks after his things. Furthermore, he takes it that whatever he's got is something given to him by the Ribbono Shel Olam. It's not just things which he's picked up somewhere, which come and go. Everything he's got has been given to him for a purpose, and he understands that and he knows that. Therefore, they're religious objects, in the same way as he wouldn't leave his tefillin lying over there, and he wouldn't leave his talis or his siddur or his shas lying over there, so he won't leave his pen or his pencil lying there either. Because his pen and pencil have as holy a purpose as any other object which he's got, which the Ribbono Shel Olam gave him. And it's not meant to be wasted and messed around. Can you imagine what Esau thinks when he sees that? When he sees his brother Yaakov, still a tzaddik, still a gadol b'torah, and he goes back because he loves his material possessions so much. He's developed a good relationship with his material possessions as well, a healthy relationship, a spiritual relationship, but a relationship nevertheless. That eats Esau up. And it's at that point that he attacks Yaakov. But Yaakov does one other thing. He takes advantage of being alone. When he gets to the other side, his family and his servants and everybody are all in the camp, and it's night time, so they're probably all asleep, safely set up on the other side of the river. He's gone back to check up that there's nothing left behind. And we're told, Vayivoser Yaakov Levado. And Yaakov remained alone. So firstly, we can appreciate those precious moments of aloneness. There he is, on his own, quiet. This is the kind of feeling you can only get in when you're camping out in the nowhere. And you can imagine what Yaakov must have felt there. There are no street lights, and no motor cars, and no telephones, and no people. Just nothing. The crickets and the frogs, and the wind, and the grass, and the reeds there by the side of the river, and the sound of the water rippling through. And there he is, levado, with no one else, on his own. What do you think at such times? You weigh yourself up, see where you're going, where have you come from. He's got a big meeting tomorrow with Esav of all people. It's not an easy time, but that's a time that one thinks. The Malbim goes further and says, Vayivoser Yaakov Levado, meaning Levado from who? He was alone from who? From his company. Well, we know he's alone from his company because it's just told us that he's put them all on the other side of the river. So who was he alone from? Says the Malbim, he was alone from himself even. He stripped himself of his physicality. And Vayivate Yaakov, it was Yaakov, the essence of Yaakov, it was Levado on its own, and he was preparing for Nevuah. He wanted a relationship with the Ribbono Shel Olam of incredible intensity at that time, and he'd stripped himself of all his physical feelings and all his physical needs and desires, and there was just the spiritual Yaakov sitting there. And he was now ready for Nevuah. Who does he meet? Sarai Shel Esau, Vayavek Ish Imoy. There's a lot of discussion in the Mefoshim as to what these words mean. Vayavek ish imay. The word Vayavek comes from the word avak, meaning dust. Now what is the difference between dust and sand? It's a big difference. Sand you can plant trees on. Sand you can build buildings on. Sand you can plant vegetables in. Sand you can plant lawns on. Sand you can make parks on. Sand you can walk on. Sand you can do all sorts of things on. In fact, the whole world is built on sand. But dust is dirt. All of a sudden, from earth, which is so important to us, if you take that earth and you make it into dust, it becomes filth. It becomes something completely negative, something that you despise and you keep on cleaning out of your house. And what is dust? Dust is earth which has become disconnected from the rest of the earth. That's all. The same stuff, it's the same material, it has the same quotas, it has the same potential, but it's not part of the whole scene. Vayeovek ish imoy is the tendency or is the effort on the part of Sarai Shel Esau, or it's a reaction against his finding that Yaakov is earthy, that this Tam ish Tam Yeshevo Alim has now made a success of business as well. And he knows how to manipulate as well. He's got the Yodayim of Esav. That's what Esav resents, to see him part of the earth. And what Esav wants to do now is to remove him from that earth and to make him like that. That's it. Okay, you're part of the earth, but I'll take you off from the earth and you're just going to be left like a piece of filth. That's what it's all about. And the battle starts. Ad alois ha-shocha, this goes on till the early hours of the morning. We're told that this dust, the Gemara says very beautifully, the same Gemara, this Gemara in Chulin is about a dust of Gemara that deals with this whole scene. But now, this dust went right up to Kisei HaKovod. It went right up to the throne of the Ribbono Shel Olam himself. In other words, this was no little just a physical argument that was taking place, a little battle. This was a major dispute between two opposite powers in the world. The battle started, according to the Malbim, the first stage of the battle took place in two stages, as we see clearly in the Chumash. The first stage, says the Malbim, was a purely spiritual stage, where he tried to create a doubt in Yaakov's mind about Emunah. He tried to shake Yaakov's belief. That was the first thing. In other words, attacking him on his area of strength. What's his area of strength? Torah. Let's tackle the Torah. Let's see whether we can't break that. And they argued and fought and argued right until the morning. That was an intellectual battle. That wasn't even a physical battle. And then we're told, Vayar ki lo yochelo. And he sees that he's unable to attack, he's unable to defeat Yaakov in that area at all. Here we've got the important part. Vayiga bechaf yorecha. So he decides to hit him at that muscle, on that muscle or on that tendon, which joins his leg to the rest of the body, and in fact enables movement in the leg. Why does he choose that? Why does he choose to hit him there? Stature. What is stature? The human being is the symbol of stature. He stands up straight, he stands up tall. Imagine a crowd of people. Thousands of people all crowding together. And another person comes over in a helicopter. Does he have more stature than the people at the bottom? No. Even though everyone at the bottom has to look up towards him? No, that's not stature. Even though he looks down on everybody else? That's not stature. Even though he can see the whole crowd of people and he can see far beyond them, he has much bigger perspective than they've got, that's not stature. That's aloofness. Stature is when you're standing down with the people and they still have to look up to you and you can still see further than them and you can still see over their heads. When your feet are on the same level as their feet but your head is miles above them, that's what stature is. That's the essence of human stature, that's the essence of Torah stature. Not aloofness. Not to take yourself away and make yourself separate. But to be part of the people around you and yet to be able to be far above the people around you. To be able to see beyond them, to be able to understand beyond them, to be able to have them looking up to you, not because you're standing on a platform, but because you are in fact bigger. That's the difference between stature and fake stature. Fake stature, they stand on little platforms. And because there's so many people around, you don't see the platform, you just see them standing tall. Real stature, when the feet are all on the same level, but the head is far above. You remember with Shaul, he's pointed out as being a head above everybody else. His head stood out above everybody else. What difference does that make? Is that a reason to make him a king? But the Talmud Rav always talks about the fact that concepts in a physical sense are the same in essence as their parallel concepts in a spiritual sense. And one that he particularly talks about is bigness. He says you talk about one pencil being bigger than another pencil. You'll talk about one mushroom being bigger than another mushroom. And in Hebrew it sounds even better because you're using the word gadol. You'll talk about a 10-year-old boy being bigger than a 5-year-old boy. And you'll talk about the greatest tzaddik in the world as being bigger than everybody else. You're using the same word right through about a mushroom and a tzaddik. To describe the difference between the tzaddik and other people, you're using the same word to describe a big mushroom from a small mushroom. Says the Talmud Rav, but they are the same. It's the same in concept, and he developed that theory. But here we've got it too. That when we talk about stature, when we talk about being tall, standing up high, we must compare the two, and we must see the closeness between them. Stature means exactly as it means in a physical sense, that you're standing on the same level as everybody else, but you're much higher than everybody else. That's what spiritual stature is. If Yaakov would have been merely involved in his Torah and would not have made a success of the Esav side of him, of the manipulative side of him, and of the business side of himself, then Esav wouldn't have been jealous. Not that much jealous. Okay, he's got his area of strength, I've got my area of strength. There's no more stature in Yaakov than in me. Maybe he's in a helicopter, maybe he's a Novi, maybe he can talk to the Ribbono Shel Olam, but that's because he's up there and I'm down here. What do you expect? If I was up there, I could also do it. What bothers Yaakov is that Yaakov's feet stand on the same ground as his feet stand on. They're on the same level when you look at their feet. They're doing the same things. They're involved in the same world. They work with the same people. And yet Yaakov stands up so tall. And Esau's a mean little so-and-so who has to scheme. You know, when you've got stature, you don't have to scheme. If you have to scheme and cheat and lie, that's because you don't have stature. A man who has to push his way through around about everybody, he can't see where he's going, he can't see above the heads of everybody else. But the man who's tall and can see above the heads of everybody else, he sees where there's an opening and he knows exactly where he wants to go and he goes. It's the little people who have to scheme and plan and plot and politic in order to get from point A to point B. And that was Esau, Ish Tzayid. He's a man who hunts. You know, if you hunt, there again, if you've got a machine gun and you've got a helicopter or a Land Rover, you don't have to go hunting. You just go and you find the animal and you shoot it. Hunting is where you're on the same level as the animal and you're playing cat and mouse. The animal might catch you, you might catch the animal, but you don't have an advantage over the animal. That's a hunter. That's what Esau was. He was dealing in a world where he had no advantage of superiority over the people with whom he was hunting. So all he could do was have advantage in terms of cheating, in terms of hiding, in terms of coming on them by surprise. That's all he could do. But Yaakov didn't have to. Yaakov could be open. Yaakov makes a deal with Laban. It's not a deal of dishonesty. It's an open deal contract that's related in the Torah exactly. And he wins. He makes a deal with Esau. Not cheating. He said, sell me your Bechorah. And he sold it. That's what bothers Esau. That Yaakov gets all this openly, whereas he has to cheat for it all the time, and then he sometimes doesn't get it. And Yaakov's made a success. I, Esau, have always advised my young people, you know, if you want to make a success in business, young man, don't be too moral. Don't think you can be too moral and make it in business, young man. That's not how the business world works. That's what I've been telling everybody, and here comes Yaakov, with all his morality and all his Torah and all his godless, and he makes it work. What does it make me look like? So you Esau decides to get him at the point of stature. That's, he'll cut him off at the legs. He'll reduce him down to size. Who does that remind us of? Remember back in Bereshis, our friend the Nachash. The one animal that doesn't have a leg. That's Esau's friend. The Nachash and Esau always go hand in hand together. The Nachash is the animal without the leg. His curse, his klolo was, you'll go in your belly. Right down at the bottom. The Nachash is a schemer. The Nachash is the sly one, because he doesn't even have the stature to see from one point to the next. He's got to wind his way in between to try and find his way out. And that's what Esau decides to try and do to Yaakov. How does he do it? He starts off by trying to challenge the Torah, because this call Yaakov Ayodayim Yedei Esau is not just a statement of fact on the part of Yitzchak, it's also a nevuah. Also a statement of the future. Yitzchak says, Chazal tell us that when Hakol Kol Yaakov, as long as you will keep your voice of Yaakov, you must know you'll be able to have the hands of Esau as well. But if you start losing your voice of Yaakov, you're going to lose your hands of Esau. You can't play Esau's game according to Esau's rules. If the Jew wants to be successful in business, it's with the Kol of Yaakov. Then you'll find you'll have the success of the Yadayim of Esau. But if you lose that Kol of Yaakov, never. You won't have the success of the Yadayim of Esau. And so Esau knows what I've got to do is I've got to get rid of that call. I've got to get rid of the Torah, that's all. Once Yaakov's not learning, I'll beat him in business. That's it. I've got to get rid of the Torah. Once I'm rid of the Torah, then we're fighting on our territory, on my territory, says Esau. My territory is the business and the politics world. In the business and the politics world alone, I'll beat him. But I've got to get rid of his Torah. So he tries first to cause doubts of his emunah. Then he says very simply, I'm going to cut down his stature. Says the Zohar. What is the stature that we're talking about? I'm sorry, I'm meant to have a Zohar with me here because the words are incredibly beautiful. Said Esau, if a man doesn't have financial wherewithal, nor does he have somebody supporting him in Torah, the Torah will be forgotten. The Zohar says. A man can't be in Torah and have to worry about where he's going to get a meal from tomorrow. He can't be in Torah and worry about his parnasa. Yes, he needs a job and he has to work for a living. But if that's causing him to come home and to think at night and worry about it and toil about it and plot and to scheme about it, he can't make any progress in Torah. says, it's very simple. All I've got to do is I've got to reduce his stature to the point where he becomes a businessman like us. And I'll tackle him at the level of the Tomchei Torah. The Tomchei Torah is the business support of Torah, which can be understood in one of two ways, both of them equally correct. You can have business support of Torah in oneself. You can have an individual who supports himself. That's how many of the Tanoim and Amoraim used to do it. And you can have shukfas, like Rabbi Rosenthal was talking about with Yisachar and Zvulun, where one learns and another one supports. But in either case, there's stature. Because what does stature depend on? Stature means not feeling obligated, not feeling dependent on other people. That's really what stature is. To be able to stand above looking above people, the first requirement is that you're not leaning on them, that you're not dependent. So you can have a man who has his own source of income, fine, so he doesn't have to worry about the people around him. Or you can have a man who has a Yisachar Zvulun kind of arrangement, that he sits and learns under somebody else, who every month goes and puts the money into his bank account and he doesn't have to worry at all. That's also fine. But the moment the man is thrown into financial turmoil, then the Torah starts being forgotten. Then he has to be careful. Says the Zohar, that's what Esav decides to do. I'll take away his financial support. His financial support are from the legs down. That's the feet walking on the ordinary earth, the same earth that I walk on. Esav says, that's the area that's now bothering me. If I can get him there, to the point where he's reduced to having to lie down on the ground, and he'll have his nose in his panosa. He'll have nothing but panosa. His whole, that's the snake, his whole head is in it. He can't even get his head out of it. It's all down with his food and with his little ground where he walks on. He can't see anything spiritually, can't see anything of height at all. He's going to be so overburdened with having to earn a living and with having to make a living, that that will be the end of his Torah. This is something one has to realize. It's not a fight between the Goyim in ourselves, between the Arabs in ourselves. This is Yaakov fighting with himself. He's now alone. He's got a bit of time to think. He's been busy with Lavan, he's been busy in business for years and years. He's looked after his Torah, he's still a Talmid Chochem. In Lavan Garti, Vatariag Mitzvah Shemarti, I've lived with Lavan, but I've observed, kept, studied, learned all the 613 mitzvahs, there's no question there. But now I'm going into a new life. What do I do? Do I give up my business altogether? Let me give the whole lot to Esav. I'm going to meet Esav tomorrow. Let me give the whole lot to Esav. Let me keep just the bare necessities of what I need, and I'll sit in a spiritual area and I'll worry about spiritual things, and that's the end of it. That's it. That's what Esav wants. Because he thinks that will increase his ability to learn. He thinks, how wonderful, I won't have to worry, I don't have to go to work tomorrow, that's all. I'll give it all to Esav, and Esav can support me. That's what Esav wants. He wants to have the control over your Torah. And he'll turn the screws when he wants to turn the screws. And when you're saying things that he doesn't like, he'll turn the screws a little bit harder. And when you're not doing, and when you're doing not doing things which he would like you to do, he'll turn the screws still a little bit harder. And you'll find yourself a nachash. You'll find yourself a snake on the ground without your stature, without your independence, having to go to Esav for every penny you want. That's what an Esav would want. And so he goes through the whole argument, he goes and he goes and he goes, and he lands up affected. He's tzoleah. He's limping. That means his relationship with the physical earth has been damaged. That stature, that uprightness that he has, that self-confidence that he had, whether he was walking into a business situation or into a base of medrash, that tremendous confidence that he had is a little bit shaken. He's now limping around. Doesn't matter to be limping around in a base of medrash, but it doesn't help to be limping around in a business situation, because that's a weakness, and in a business situation people take advantage of a weakness. So he's been hurt, he's been damaged. But then, Vayomer Shacheni, things turn. It's the angel who then says to Esav, not like the drush I gave last night, it's then the angel of Esav who says to Yaakov, Shacheni, send me away. And the medrash says, When somebody asks you to send them, then you're the important one. Right? Because it's morning time. And Yaakov says, I won't until you bless me. What's going on here? There's a change. Up till this point, Yaakov was the one who was suffering. At this moment, things change. All of a sudden, the Sar of Esav, the angel of Esav, start losing ground because the sun's coming. What's it going to do with it? Let's go a little bit further, and you'll see clearly what it's going to do with it. So Yaakov says, we'll come back to this business in a moment. Yaakov says, I won't send you ki im beirachtani until you've given me a brocha. What does that mean? Say the Mefoshim, you've got to acknowledge that both brochas belong to me. Vayomer, and he says, Vayomer alav mashmech, he says to him, what is your name? What is your essence? Vayomer Yaakov, he says, they call me Yaakov. Yaakov's a little bit of a derogatory name. It had become derogatory. It wasn't given to him in a derogatory sense, but Esav had turned it into a derogatory name. And he says, you'll remember at the end of Tolos, already twice, he's cut me by the ankle. He's come chasing after me and he's tripped me. That's what it really means. Yaakov, the one that trips by the ankle. And Yaakov says, my name is Yaakov. Almost embarrassedly. Your name will no longer mean it in the derogatory sense. He's not renaming him here, because he gets renamed later on in chapter 35 by the Ribbono Shel Olam himself. This is not the renaming. He's still called Yaakov, but he says, your name will not have the connotation of Yaakov anymore. Kiim Yisrael, but it will now be called Yisrael. Then your name will mean Yisrael. Kisoriso im Elokim v'imanoshim v'atucho. Because you have battled with the Ribbono Shel Olam and with people, and you've been successful. Says the Gemara again in Chulin Daf Sadi Beis. Amar Rabbo, says Rabbo, Remez Romazloi, he gave him a hint. She'asidim shnei sorim latzeis mimenu, the two princes are going to come out from him. Rosh Goyla Shebevovel, the Nosi Shebeeretz Yisrael, the head of the Golus in Bovel, in Babylon, and the Nosi in Eretz Yisrael. What does that mean? Those aren't only two people. Every Jew came out of Yaakov. What does it mean, just those two? And what's the connection here? You remember we discussed a while back, and Rabbi Feuffer raised the whole thing again when he spoke here on that evening, the difference between Torah in Eretz Yisrael and Torah in Bavel. The Yerushalmi and the Bavli. Torah Shebaal Peh and Torah Shebichtav. And we said there are really two aspects in learning Torah. On the one hand, there are the principles of Torah, the statements of Torah. And for that one needs tmimus. For that you need a pure, unadulterated, open mind to understand. That's it. Don't try and impose your own thoughts on it. Don't try and make it fit into your own ideas. Just open your mind and see carefully what's written there. Right? And that's the Torah Shebichtav. Our relationship with the written Torah is one of tmimus. Just understand what's there. And we've discussed several times that the concept of Torah Shebichtav has been a dynamic process. Although halachically it's only the Tanakh which is Torah Shebichtav, philosophically it's a lot more than that. When the Mishnah was written down, the Mishnah became kind of Torah Shebichtav, and we now don't play around with the Mishnah anymore. We just learn it and know it and understand it. That's it. And then the Gemara was the Torah Shebichtav. That's where all the discussion was. Then the Gemara was written down, that became the Torah Shebichtav. And the Netziv says it goes right on. The things that have been written in the last generation, the Chazon Ish and the Mishnah Berurah and so on and so forth, that's now Torah Shebichtav. You can't fiddle around with it, it's there. And you open your mind and you learn it as it's there, that's all. You've got to know and understand it. And it goes still further, says the Netziv, anything which you are not Mechadesh yourself, anything which you don't create yourself in learning but you hear from a Rebbe, has the din of Torah Shebichtav. And the method of learning it is the method of Tzmimus. Just hear it carefully and understand it, absorb it. That's it. Once you've got Torah Shebichtav in this general sense inside you, then starts Torah Shebaal Peh. Torah Shebaal Peh is extending what you've learned to areas you haven't learned. And for that you need brilliance. For that you need pilpul. For that you need chokhmah. For that, there comes the whole art of Torah. You need the sharpness of learning. And right through the Gemara you often see discussions about the importance of sharpness, harifus, and the importance of knowledge, just plain knowing what's there. And the clarity, the difference between clarity and harifus. And in fact the Gemara at times tries to weigh up which is the preferable one. If you have a Talmid Chacham who excels in harifus, in sharpness, and you have one who excels in clarity, which is the better one, and so on and so forth. But really one needs both. One needs the clarity and the tmimus to understand the Torah Shebichtav, and one needs the harifus to extend the Torah Shebichtav to new areas. Rabbi Teufel explained that the Yerushalmi had a direct line of tradition back. They didn't have to work out anything themselves. All they had to do was listen with an open ear and understand. So for that they needed the Tmimus. That's why the Yerushalmi says the Netziv has more Kedusha, it has more holiness than the Bavli. But the Gemara that we learn is the Talmud Bavli, because that has the Charifus, that has the sharpness. There they didn't have all the knowledge that they had in Eretz Israel. They had to work it all out for themselves. And so we have these two pillars of Talmud. We have the Talmud Yerushalmi, which is the thing as it was handed down. We have the Talmud Bavli, which is the thing as it was worked out mentally. And the beauty is the close correlation between the two of them. In conclusions, they're virtually identical, with very few exceptions. They're absolutely identical. Says the Gemara, says Rabbi here, this is a hint to Yaakov, that in your children there's going to be the Bavli and the Yerushalmi together. The Yerushalmi will come out from your Tmimus. That's where that will come from. And the Bavli, the ability to be brilliant and creative in your learning, that's going to come from the Esav part that you've acquired, from the sharpness that you've acquired. In other words, he's saying to Yaakov, he's saying, I acknowledge that it all belongs to you. And not only does it all belong to you in the sense that you have the business side in your hands and you have the Torah side in your hands as well, but both your business skill and your Torah skill are going to be applied within Torah itself to produce two completely different angles to Torah. The Tmimus of Yerushalmi and the Charifus of Bavli. The Tmimus of Torah Shebichtav and the Charifus of Torah Shebalpeh. It's through this that creativity in learning among your descendants will be guaranteed, as well as accuracy. Because you've always got the problem. If you're very accurate, the chances are you're not going to be creative. I can repeat what I heard very accurately. That's nice. I've got a good memory. But it doesn't mean that you're creative. And if you're creative, you run the risk of not being accurate. So you come up with all sorts of lovely ideas, but you don't have the accuracy. Now, Yaakov has within him the possibility now of creating a people who have the accuracy of Tmimus of Yaakov, plus the brilliant scheming of the Bavli, which Yaakov has now acquired. We've discussed already many times the order. The first one has to have clarity and Tmimus in the Torah Shebaal Peh, in the Torah Shebichtav. You have to know the Chumash and the Gemara in front of you with absolute clarity. And with the Rashi and Tosfos as well, and with the Rishonim and Poskim and Achronim as well, and with everything your Rebbe's got to say on it, absolutely clearly. When you know that absolutely clearly, then starts your own process of creativity, of taking those principles further and coming up with new ideas. Now, Vayishal was still one more point, then we come back to the fact that the sun rose and that's when he asked to be sent. Vayishal Yaakov Vayomer Hagidono Shmecha. Yaakov says, okay, tell me, who have I been fighting with? What is your name? I want to understand this Yetzirah. I've beaten it, but I want to be able to beat it always. And tomorrow I'm going to meet Esav in the flesh. I want to know how to handle him. Who are you? What do you stand for? What makes you tick, Yetzirah? Esav, what makes you work? What makes you function? Answers you, Esav, and this is Reb Leib Chassman's idea. Vayomer, and he says, and this is his answer, Lama ze tish al lishmi. I am the one about whom you mustn't ask what my name is. Don't try and define me. I'm the one that the moment you try and define me, there's nothing there. That's what I am. And that's an incredible concept of what the Yetzer Hara is. I'll explain it. The snake. The snake represents two dimensions. Two dimensional movement. The snake has no stature. It can move left, right, it can move north, south, east, west, but it can't move up. The human being can move all the directions that the snake can move, and he can move up as well. That's the difference. The Yetzer Hara, we're told, is like the snake. And we see clearly from this parasha that what Esav wanted to do was to reduce the human being to a snake level, that Yaakov should only be able to move in a two-dimensional way. Why? Because when you're moving in two dimensions, you're standing in one position, and you want to get from here to there. So you go there. What do you do now? You get bored. So you've got to go somewhere else. Have you ever seen people who travel a lot? You know, they come from holiday and they go to holiday in one place and then another place, always in another place. Not because they have to, not because of business, not because they're going to visit Gedolim, not because they're going to see a specific concert or a play or some specific thing in a particular area, or they're going to an exhibition, just traveling for the sake of traveling, being on the move. Have you ever seen people always have to get out every night? They go to the movies one night and they go to play cards the next night, and they're always on the move. People who are always on the move are snakes. That's it. Because the snake, once he gets there, the challenge is over. There's nothing left to do. He can only move in two dimensions. So now I'm here. So now what? Got to go somewhere else. So the snake is always moving, moving from one place to another. The human being, Yaakov, is different. Moves from point A to point B. And then the snake will say, come, let's go on. They'll say, why go on? Just look what's here. Look at the depths. I can stand here for a year without moving. Deeper and deeper and deeper, and I'm discovering new things without having to move. That's why you remember back to the famous Vilna Gaon and the Pasuk of Mishli. Right? That the tzaddik, that the Rosh is the one who always wants to learn more. Come on, let's turn the page. Let's finish the book. Let's get on with it. Come on, let's move. That's the snake. Once he's learned a piece of Gemara, he knows it. Let's go on. Not the tzaddik. The tzaddik has to be pulled away, because each thing he sees, each moment he spends deepening his knowledge in what he sees, whether it's a sight that he sees, whether it's a person that he meets, whether it's a word of Torah that he's learning, whether it's a piece of information he's gathered, the more he dwells on it, the more he matures it, the more he plays with it, the deeper it gets, and the deeper it gets, and the deeper it gets. And that's ruchnius, that's spirituality. But the snake's got none of this third dimension. There is no spirituality. So all he's got is quantity. So he moves from one place to the next. The next point is that in the case of the snake, the tragedy is that when he's standing here and he looks there, it looks a wonderful place to get to. Seems to have everything that this place doesn't have. Why? Because it involves another trip. That's really why. Because it involves movement. I'm bored where I am. So anything is better. So he looks at the next place and it looks wonderful. When he gets there, there's nothing there. It's just the same as the place he's come from. If there is anything new, it takes him a moment to experience what's new, and he's bored again. So in the case of the Yetzer Hara, as you satisfy your explorative need, your explorative need disappears for that area. And so it is with taiva altogether. As a taiva is fulfilled, you know, a taiva's greatest moment is before its fulfillment. The greatest part of a meal is when you sit down to it. But when you finished it, it's all over, it's all gone. Not so with a piece of Gemara. You sit down to the piece of Gemara, it's miserable, and you don't know that you'll ever get into it, and you break your back, and you break your head, and you work, and you work. But when you close your Gemara at the end, what a feeling you've got inside. What knowledge, what new insight, what understanding. That's the difference between quality and quantity. Quantity, as you've achieved it, so you've made it, okay. So you've won the race. Now what? It's all gone. It's anticlimactic. Torah is the opposite. Tamu ura'u. Taste and you'll see how good the word of the Ribbono Shel Olam is. Doesn't work with us on in physical things. Taste and you'll get sick of it. What's in Torah? Taste and you'll like it. And if you don't like it, you didn't taste the real thing. If you heard a shir or you learnt a piece of Torah and you didn't like it, you either didn't understand it or what you heard wasn't Torah. But tamu ura'u, if you've tasted Torah, you will see that it's good. And the more you taste it and the more you eat it, the better it is, and the better it is, and the better it is. That's the difference between the two. And so he says, Lama ze tishal lishmi. Don't ask, why are you asking who I am? I'm the one that when you understand me, I've gone. I'm not there. It looks nice. I'm the one that looks attractive. But when you get to know me, you see it's absolutely empty. Everything looks wonderful, looks beautiful, fancy lights. And if you look at the system of advertising for the Yetzer Hara, it's all superficial advertising. Make the thing look good. Don't tell the person that it is good. Make it look good. That's all. The wrapping must be good. The quality of the article doesn't have to be that good. If the wrapping is good, if its presentation is good, he'll come and he'll buy it. Once he's bought it, you've got the money. You don't have to worry. That's how the Yetzer Hara works. It's effective marketing. But it doesn't work that way in Torah. The Torah has to get better and better as one learns more and more. And now one understands why he says, you must send me now because the sun has risen. There's one thing that the Yetzer Hara can't stand, and that's clarity. That's all. The Blade Chassman says you can lie in bed one evening and you can see the lights from outside through the curtains playing on the wall and making the most beautiful patterns. And you look and your imagination takes hold of you, and you watch these patterns playing, and they're absolutely beautiful. And you get so excited that you turn on the lights of your room to see them better. They're gone. Because that's what imagination is. Imagination is only good when there's obscurity. The moment there's clarity, the moment there's knowledge, it all disappears. And that's again why Einam Ha'aretz Chosid. You can't be frum and ignorant. Because when you're ignorant, there's place for this fellow Esav. He does all sorts of things, and he fools you in all sorts of ways, and you don't know the difference. The moment you challenge him, the moment you try and define him, the moment you throw light on him, light is clarity, in the night time he flourishes. The moment the morning comes up, he disappears. He can't take the bright light. He can't be looked at straight in the eye. Here we have the concept, and we'll understand. There was a fight between Yaakov and Esav. Who won? Esav won, not Yaakov. But not true. Esav lost. But who beat Esav? Not Yaakov. The son beat Esav. That's what it is. Yaakov played for time. He says, let me go now because the sun's coming up. Not let me go now because you're hurting me. Not let me go now because you've captured me. Let me go because the sun's coming. He says, Yaakov, give me a bracha first. Let's understand what's going on first. Because now he's terrified. Once you've thrown chochma, once you've thrown facts at the Yetzirah, he becomes like jelly. He becomes completely innocuous. And he becomes completely ineffective. And here we understand the statement of Mishlei and Perek Tzayin. Tov erech hapayim migibor. A man with patience is better than a gibor. Because there are people you can't beat with gevurah. There are people you can't beat with might. But provided you're working with chokhmah, provided you know that what you're doing is right at every step, provided you're knowledgeable, provided you know what you're doing, you just have to wait. That's all. Wait until the sun comes, because that's the way of the world. We have periods of darkness followed by periods of light. Individuals have it, nations have it, history has it. Darkness, light, so it goes. You just have to wait, that's all. The light will come, and when the light comes, your foe will disappear. Someone understands that although Yaakov was a gibor, although Yaakov was incredibly powerful and mighty and strong, and although he had all the chokhmah, and although he had all the siyata dishmaya, what he beats Esav with in the end is a midah tova, a good characteristic. That's it. Esav was the coarse guy. That was the why he was thrown out, because he didn't have the midahs. Yaakov beats Esav with one good midah, erech hapayim. Just the patience to sit it out in the knowledge that chokhmah and clarity must ultimately win.